Yeah, so this is the book that needs to be written, right?
Welcome back to another episode of East in the Arena, a place where we talk to East members about the unique things they do, why they do them, and how. Jeremy Levin here, and I'm joined by my co-hosts, Sean Murley.
Hey, everybody. This is Sean Murley.
And Mike Radomski.
Hey, everyone. This is Mike Radomski.
Now, before we get started, we want to introduce a new co-host to the In the Arena crew, one of several new hosts that will be entering the ITA family over the coming months, Andrea Soros.
Hi, I'm Andrea Soros. I'm a trauma surgeon in Colorado Springs. I work at Penrose Hospital, which is a state level 2 trauma center. I did my internship at Brown and then finished my training at UT Nashville and did my fellowship at EVMS and graduated this last summer. So I'm a new attending and new to East and learning a lot.
Cool. Welcome to the team.
On today's episode, we get the opportunity to learn about what it takes to build a trauma center from scratch. And if you're like me, you've never really given that much thought. I've always worked in trauma centers that have existed for, well, it seems like forever. But when a trauma center doesn't exist and needs to, there are truly Herculean tasks that need to be undertaken to get it going. Enter Dr. Ken Wilson, who over the last 6 years has taken the University of Chicago from nothing to a veritable powerhouse of a trauma center. But before he got into the trauma realm, he started medical school at Howard University thinking he was going to do something else.
When I went to Howard, I thought I wanted to be a cardiologist. And then I just realized I could not stand medical rounds because they would just never fix anything. We just talked about it for hours on end. And so I said, if I got to do 3 years of this and 2 years of cardiology, I'm out. So I did the surgical rotation and it was amazing.
And following a residency at Grady Memorial Hospital in Atlanta, he went on to complete a fellowship in trauma.
I did the 2-year fellowship at Henry Ford. And so I went to Detroit.
After which he went back to Grady for a time. Until he ended up into a place that you probably wouldn't expect.
Everyone always says, who goes to Flint, Michigan in their right mind? Well, people who like this patient population.
Meaning prototypical trauma and emergency general surgery.
You're just doing everything. You're doing, I mean, we even added robotic surgery to the building. I mean, you know, it's like it was free reign to do everything.
So Ken did that for 2 years, and then he got a fateful call.
I get a call from Selwyn Rogers, who's a division chief at the University of Chicago. Saying, hey, we've been looking for you. And I said, what do you mean? He's like, we're open to trauma center in the University of Chicago.
And the job starts in March of 2018, but he arrives in August of 2017. And on his arrival, he asks the key question.
Where do you even begin? So my role was to be very specific. So Dr. Rogers was called by the University of Chicago because he looks like the University of Chicago in the sense that he's a Harvard, you know, erudite guy. So what is my role? Why are they calling me? Because I do unsexy, dirty, ghetto trauma in Atlanta and in Flint, right? So my job is to do the thing.
Ghetto trauma.
I feel like that's very appropriate for the South Side of Chicago.
I don't know what that means. I assume he means like knife and gun club type stuff.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
There's clean trauma and there's dirty trauma, and he does only dirty trauma.
So Ken arrives in August of 2017, but there's a problem. It's not like a new hospital or a new building is going to be built for him. So he has to figure out how exactly is he going to get it all together.
I have a slide where it's the University of Chicago, and I literally have, you know, like around it in a circle, like Grady, Penn, LA County, and I have arrows pointing. Like, how do you shove all these buildings in here and make these systems collide? Because if we start knocking off the lung transplants time slot or, you know, the double bypass, right? If anybody gets delayed, all the people who didn't want this system here, it's like we're giving them fodder.
So that means you have to be fairly creative about how you situate yourself in the building and how you conduct the processes required to take care of your patients.
We're on the ground floor in one building in a parking deck. Literally, I'm talking to you in my office in a parking deck. And I am above the emergency room. My feet are above the emergency room, which is in the parking deck. You have to go out of the parking deck, across a bridge, into the main building, and then up 6 floors.
That's from where to where? ED to OR?
That's ED to OR.
Wow.
Yeah.
That sounds terrifying.
It makes me nervous to go one floor up to our OR. So, you know, I'm bringing a scalpel with me and waving it like sage just to like ward off evil spirits. And here he is going to a different building altogether. Like that's rough, man.
Many of our episodes, the
the infrastructure of the building has dictated the type of trauma done there, right? Jill streams at Vandy. The building is set up to do trauma the way they do it. If your building can't accommodate that, the other types of infrastructure that you can build are the personnel. You can't change the location of the operating room in relation to the emergency room. Then you have to change the people that staff those rooms so they can operate as efficiently as possible to do what you need to do.
So we carved out a niche in the ED, and we trained all those nurses, those techs, and they became like family. We taught them to be like medics, you know, out in Afghanistan. Like, it was pride on how fast can you get that thing upstairs. So we were like a freaking pit crew. Like, we would like practice this thing till we get it down to four. We took like the tallest guy, put him on the stretcher. We would simulate this stuff, and we would figure out how to get up the back elevator and how to get to the OR 17.
And what's really impressive about all of this is the sheer scope of the undertaking. Basic topics at literally every point of care for your patient have to essentially be taught anew.
We're having to teach anesthesiologists how to, you know, do one-to-one-to-one, like literally the basics, that like, where does the blood fridge sit? None of that existed.
All right, so not to sound condescending or anything, but if he could come to my institution and teach my anesthesiologist how to do one-to-one-to-one, I'd really be appreciative of it.
You know, we're having fights about, well, the ED wants the level one, but they want the Belmont upstairs. And what are you going to do? How are you going to change this out? Why are you doing it this way? I remember when I first got here, it was like, well, who's going to do, you know, chief of anesthesia, who's going to do your intubations? Because we're not coming downstairs because we're really busy. And me going, okay, what do you mean, okay? I mean, okay, we'll take care of it. Well, how are you going to take care of it? Don't worry about it. And so after a while, you're like, well, wait, we wanted to, like, okay, well, sure, you can come do that. We had to fix everything. How can I fight with you but still make you like me? Because that was really my job.
It just seems like a Herculean task.
I was going to say, it sounds really freaking hard.
But Ken was really thoughtful in how he conducted himself and how he built his center. He knew from his prior experiences in the Army as a trauma surgeon of who you need to empower and what you need to do to be successful as a team.
I would say the smartest thing, you know, that I've ever done was raise my hand and say, I'm going to go downrange. When I raised it prior to 9/11, and there was no one that had flown buildings, planes into buildings in New York yet. And then when I was in fellowship, 9/11 happened. And so one of the things that I learned from six deployments, literally to a war zone, the most impactful person in that setting is the medic, is the person who literally puts on the tourniquet, applies wounds, whatever that is.
Or as Ken says, there needs to be support of the least sophisticated entity on the team.
And what I mean by that is that's a 19, 20-year-old doesn't do the thing on a military base back home, right? Because there's no shootings. The speed limit is 25 miles an hour and the guns are in the armory. But if I can put everything in his head, he makes my job easy.
Yeah, I think we can all testify when you have like nurses or OR staff who will help you and work with you versus those who don't, how much that can change your quality of life and then also the patient's care. Elevating those support people can really make such a difference in all of that.
You could have the best trauma surgeon at the head of the bed, but if your bedside nurses or your techs can't do the most basic things like get an IV, start the Belmont, whatever it may be, then it's all for nothing.
So the smartest thing that we did was to empower our techs and nurses everywhere we went, you know, and then let the nurses talk to their leadership. So our trauma bay was that. It was a four resuscitative surgical team. You know, we taught them everything in our heads. We treat them with respect. It's kind of like an officer and a gentleman movie, right? You got the spoiled officers being taught by a drill sergeant, right? But at the end of the day, that the officer is going to outrank the sergeant, but you better respect the sergeant because he knows where every braid of glass is. He knows every regulation.
So that means if you come onto their service and you have an issue with the nurse?
We're going to support the nurse first because we're going to say, you've been here for 1 month. They were a nurse 10 years over at county. Once the nurses see that you have their back, then you let them kind of fight for you with the officers in their division. So once they see that we are literally actively engaged, it just kind of, we got our tentacles everywhere.
So it's really impressive the amount of work that Ken's put in to train his nurses, his techs, and figure out how to get his patients from the trauma bay to the OR. But there's one key thing that his trauma center is missing right now. And that's Trauma Surgeons. So he sets out to hire his team, but he's really only able to get people straight from fellowship because...
no mid-level career person, senior person is going to take a big chance on this. So in the process of building this, you have on my team, just by representation, the institution, Shock Trauma, LA County, Penn, Cincinnati, old trauma center as well, and of course, Grady.
That's pretty stacked.
Pretty good pedigree there.
So everybody came in, you know, being a Demetriades clone, a Scalia clone, you know, bunch of egos. And I'm the guy from Grady, but I'm not the famous guy from Grady. So no one's going to listen to me.
Speaking from personal experience, I was probably the really annoying partner that came out. I was like, you know, at Vandy.
I can see that.
Yeah, right. Vandy, we did this. And I was probably so annoying. And my partners are so like gracious because they didn't point it out.
I don't know what you guys are talking about because there's only one way of doing it, and that's the Denver way.
So the first thing we had to do was to get them to figure out we have to stop talking in terms of our institutions, but each institution has their own individual strengths. And there's some dogma from each individual institution that we just don't want to reproduce the bad things here by grafting that onto the process. So we spent a year writing about 16 protocols.
Yeah, I feel like that is like one thing that I've observed in like the institutions that I've worked in is that there's always like a little bit of dogma and a little bit of this is the way that we do it. And to unpack that and peel that back can be really difficult. But if you're starting with all new people, then you kind of have the opportunity to start fresh.
Writing protocols really forces you to dive into the literature and actually see if there's data to support these dogma or if they're just myths. So this is what sounds like a really good way to dive into that.
There's a pitfall with that because what are you going to, you come from Penn and you want to write a protocol. Who are the people you're going to cite, right? It's going to be all the people you know.
And so let's just say I already give you blunt splenic rupture management. You take that assignment. Each one has like five articles. You know, it's got to be the current literature to discuss how we do these things. And you have four articles from Feliciano and Jamie Coleman. I'm going to send you right back and say, go look somewhere else because you're just continuing what I said not to do. And so we probably banged on each other for like the first 6 months like that, just to try to get our team set up.
What a really good process of, like Andrea said, peeling back and analyzing exactly what you're doing.
I also feel like it's a different thing to make a protocol than update a protocol. And in a lot of really established places, you're just updating. That's a project.
So you're going to make a trauma center and you're going to do all of these things. Hire staff, make processes, insert yourself into the building. How much time should you allot yourself?
You got to give us 5 years. You would never expect a CEO to come in and flip all the switches and make the hospital go from red to black unless you give him or her, you know, some amount of time.
But during that time, there is an opportunity cost.
There are going to be really smart medical students and residents who are going to come along who are going to want to say, hey, that's an interesting idea and I want to write a paper with you. But what was lacking was this was all grassroots. We didn't have, you know, enough registrars. We were staffed to think we were going to have 2,500 at the most. That's what we were told. We were 5,000 in a year and a half. So it's kind of hard with the same number of people to do twice the number of cases.
Yeah, I mean, you can't farm out all your people to do other tasks when they're clinical all the time because you are so busy.
And it sounds like they had to turn away a lot of potential opportunity to do X, Y, or Z because you had to keep your kind of eye on the prize. Like they hired assuming X number and that number doubled. Like it's got to be drinking from a fire hose. 5,000.
That's nonstop. That's just nonstop. So they had to ramp up quickly.
But now they're at year five. And having gone through most of the growing pains, they're able to ask some important questions about what their staff wants and what keeps them motivated.
What we're doing is what makes you happy away from the clinical. For me, being someone that's seen people step on IEDs where I can fix the vessel and shunt it, but then there's the metabolic uncoupling that happens from being blown up, the reperfusion injury, you know, all the other stuff that we know, the cytokine storm. So now we have people coming on who want to answer those questions. So we're about to inherit a septicemia lab. We're trying to fund a resuscitation, acute resuscitation lab. So now we're at year five and we're trying to become, get the PhDs on board and get all those questions. So in the first 5 years, it had to be about being clinically excellent.
Does he feel like there was a large institutional support for them, or was it kind of secondary? Because that would really make or break the attitude.
It sounded like there was institutional support, but the guy doing his standard XYZ case is not going to give OR time up. There's only limited lab space, so there's still going to be limited resources. So the institution supports them. But I'm sure there's people who are like, they don't want trauma around because it's ghetto trauma, right?
Yeah. I mean, as you said, it's dirty. Like, yeah. Our job is dirty, and it gets in the way of everyone else doing their nice, clean cases.
Sterility. Who needs it?
The pillar has to be balanced upon the clinical strength. And then over here, you know, you want to smack a rat over the head, that's fine. If you want to go over here, why is there violence in the South Side? You know, blah, 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 do that as well. But it's got to be what we built it on for 5 years, is that we have to be interchangeable parts in the operating room.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Creating that clinical foundation first, establishing it for a few years, and then developing other things around that.
There is a cost to be paid, though, for striving for clinical excellence as you establish your center, while your volume is ballooning to 5,000 admissions a year. How do you build in a culture of wellness and support so we don't all just burn out?
It's a hard topic. You know, remember I talked about that original crew that came in? You know, we did 24s. We would do Friday and Sunday weekends. So, you know, you go home on Sunday, Saturday and sleep, and, you know, and you meet 20 people when you come back. And they became incredibly good because it was drinking from a fire hose. And so then you see the wear and tear, and then you see, let's hire more people. But then there's also the gradient of, if I'm bringing too many people, then I don't have proficiency, and the younger people don't become as good as the people who were here when we first opened.
Sean lit up like a light bulb.
Throwback to the Pat Murphy episode. That's literally exactly what he's talking about.
Yeah.
When you have a small group of people and then you expand, you have to have other things for those new people to do. It's a great connection back to the other episode.
And this is Ken's take on what they've done to ensure wellness within their staff.
I do believe that we have to allow time for the person who really wants to be in the ICU and not trying to figure out how to put together, you know, an axillary artery injury to him in the morning, to do more of that. We have to allow the person who wants to be the MD PhD to be more PhD than MD, because you just can't, because you're right, because that's the academic part. And I think that the way that we did it, or doing it to mitigate some of that burnout, is really like each other. And I think that's the thing. Like, so if you want to go take your kid to this White Sox game, I'll take your call. And there's no, I'm not keeping track, right? It's not like you're exhausting me. I'm just doing what I want to do.
All right. First of all, let's be clear. The Cubs are definitely, like, you know, the more beloved team, and Wrigley Field is better. So, yeah.
I'm just going to take your word. I don't really understand sports ball. It would be impossible to fully distill down exactly what Ken has done over the last 5 years into a nice recap of how to build a trauma center. But there are some general points that he lays out that if you're going to do this, you should follow. First,
start speaking in terms of what your center's capable of doing. So that means that somebody's got to be in the building first, and they need at least a year or two headway. So in other words, if you're going to open up a center in 2027, someone's got to be in 2025. And for 2 years, looking around and seeing what the strengths and weaknesses are.
So just learning the system first.
Next, start finding your team.
When I think about year out, you can start picking your team. You can start interviewing people and figure out who you want, and hopefully they'll take it.
But Ken cautions, don't just hire anybody. You have to hire people that are down with the mission and the type of patients you're going to see at your center.
Because everyone's going to be really excited about having, you know, the brand new toy. But what happens is, when you get tired, you default back to the thing that you were doing before. So if you're doing public policy and you say, I'm going to come to Chicago and do gunshot wounds, after your 20th night of call, you're going to see they're going to start to fall off.
Not everyone is built out for every center necessarily. If you come from if you don't enjoy penetrating trauma, this place ain't for you.
Where I did my fellowship at EVMS, it's a great place to train. There's a lot of penetrating trauma, and it got so depressing after a while because you saw so many people were shot, and like young kids to like old people. So it's hard.
I mean, it's probably hard as the trauma medical director to find people to staff your center, especially as he said earlier, when you're primarily getting people straight from fellowship.
flip this on the other way around. I'd be like, you know, you're the interviewee. Yeah, come join me at a great trauma center. It's gonna be built next year. It's like, hey, what's it gonna be like? Don't know. Well, what's my shift gonna look? Don't know. What am I gonna be working like? Don't know.
Yeah.
Here's another corollary to one of our previous episodes with the medical device making, right? Like, you spend years working on something and
yeah,
you don't know if it's going to pan out in the end.
Those are two callbacks in one episode. What's going on?
We need one more. Trifecta.
Step 3, find your trauma program staff that are going to take your center from good to great.
Make sure that you have a good trauma program manager who is seasoned, right? Who has, you know, been around the block, and you know, even if you have to select them, even if you don't know one, like Society of Trauma Nursing or something like that, go find that person who is energetic and wants to do that.
I love my trauma program manager and trauma program staff. They're fantastic.
Yeah. The people at my shop are phenomenal.
Yeah. I feel like as a resident though, you're just like, why is this person like harping on this stuff? And then as an attendee, you're like, thank you for keeping our entire program together.
Number 4, lead from the front.
You can't just pick your team to step back, right? People have to see that you're going to do just as much, if not more.
I think so highly of that. Like, not to call back to my training, but Bob Strani was like that. He's like, listen, I'll take call. I'll do it. You don't want to do it? I'll take care of it. It's fine. You know what I mean? Like, I'm going to work just as much as you, if not more. And when you have a case that's difficult, I'll come in and I'll take care of it.
And finally,
you have to have a connection to the community that you serve. So in that year that you're here, you should be out meeting the community leaders, people in the hospital who've been here for a while, and getting their input. Go find those people in the community, in the hospital, because without their support, you can't be successful.
Well, that's us. We want to thank Dr. Ken Wilson for his time and for sharing what he has learned while making the University of Chicago the trauma center it is today. And whether you're starting a level 1 on your own or simply trying to improve the one you are at, we hope Ken's insights and experiences can help along the way. East in the Arena is a product of the Educational Resources Committee and created by Jeremy Levin, Sean Murley, and Mike Radomski. If you want to check out more In the Arena episodes or other East products like the TraumaCast or CareerCast, visit east.org or wherever fine podcasts are found. This episode was produced by me, Jeremy Levin. Intro and outro music were created and performed by Matt Holzmacher. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.
I'm sorry, you and your fancy pen acronyms, ESS.
Oh, I'm sorry, EGS, ESS, Emergency Surgery Service.
It means acute care surgery.
ACS, EGS, ESS.
No, yeah. You're wrong. ESS.
Right, exactly, because it's pen, you know.